the presentation of this participation report by the content advisor. Can I just directly hand over to them?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to the honourable members. Chairperson, myself and Valeria are going to take the committee through the integrated report on the public participation process for the General Business Laws Amendment Bill. Chairperson, the report essentially provides an overview of the public participation process, highlighting key issues that have emanated from this process as well as the recommendations thereof. Now, Chairperson, would like your indulgence on the fact that when we present the document, we'll only speak to the headings and not necessarily go into detail paragraph by paragraph, page by page. And if that's okay, Chairperson, then we'll also be then surmising some of the issues that have come up that we'll indicate as we go along, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, Chairperson, the report is really separated into four parts. Part A speaks to stakeholder engagement. Part B speaks to the provincial hearings, Part C to national hearings, and then the last part, Part D, speaks to the written submission. I will do Part A and then I will do Part B. By the way, if we're starting from the page, by way of all the review chapters in Section 59 and 72, there's a positive obligation on Parliament to facilitate public engagement in the legislative process. Now, this obligation has then been settled and interpreted in court, and what has been found is that Parliament is obligated to facilitate meaningful and reasonable public participation. Now, Parliament has then done is to codify what it means by reasonable public participation, and it's done that by creating a public participation framework. And this framework seeks to guide Parliament's work in how to achieve public participation such that it allows for meaningful engagement and reasonable engagement in its processing of the bills. Now, the key features of this public participation framework relate specifically to public hearings. And that is, Chairperson, if you go to page 2, we'll see where we're speaking of the key issues which are bulleted, and it speaks to pre-hearing workshops that must be held in order to establish relationships with stakeholders, to develop effective communication and awareness programs, ensure that communities are mobilized, ensure that consultations and meetings are convened, ensure that summaries of the bill are translated in 3 languages spoken in that particular province, as well as transportation to be provided. Now, Chairperson, we must insert that in facilitating these public participation process, the committee really tried to align and to ensure adherence to these principles such that it is indeed ensuring reasonable public participation. Chairperson, in recognizing its constitutional obligation, this committee then decided to develop a public participation plan, which was then subdivided into 4 inputs. So you used four methods to solicit public inputs. The first method that was used, Chairperson, was the engagement with stakeholders within the intelligence sector. This sought to engage stakeholders which would have been affected by the amendment of the 3 pieces of legislation. Specifically, Chairperson, the committee dealt with or engaged NECOC, the IGI, as well as Cybercrime Intelligence. It then moved on to solicit written submissions from the public. In this regard, Chairperson, the committee published an advert in 11 languages in national and provincial newspapers, and gave a 3-week allocation for public to receive public comment. This is important, Chairperson, because this 3-week demarcation is a stipulation or requirement for the so that was adhered to. It's important then also to note that, Chairperson, when the committee received request to extend the written submission deadline, the committee had conceded and extended that deadline to the 15th of February and not the 31st of January as initially indicated. From there, Chairperson, the third way of receiving inputs, the committee then conducted in-person hearings where the committee went to 5 respective provinces and then used participate provinces in the province, a district, municipality, and a local municipality was then identified through that. And the last one, Chairperson, was then through oral submissions. So emanating from the written submissions, some stakeholders have indicated that they would like to input to engage the committee in terms of their input, and that was then allowed. But further to that, the committee then identified critical stakeholders within the intelligence sectors, specifically people who would have given a nuanced perspective to allow for a better understanding or a better perspective of certain decisions that were made. In this regard, we're speaking to including participants such that were involved in a high-level review panel through the presence of Professor Jane Duncan, the former Inspector General in Intelligence, was also then invited to become part of these stakeholders that then submitted oral responses. Chairperson, in section, page 3 rather, which is section 3, the point speaks to the background and objectives of the bill. So essentially, what gave rise to this bill? You would know, or perhaps not, in 2009, the Civilian Intelligence Services, which were, had been amalgamated into a single intelligence service. This intelligence service was in the SS, was in Crete. This intelligence service was the SSA. The creation of the SSA happened through a presidential proclamation, Proclamation 59 of 2009. This creation of a new intelligence organization through a presidential proclamation was irregular because it was in deviation of what Section 209 of the Constitution says, that says the president must can create an intelligence service, but it needs to be in line with legislation. Chairperson, we do note that the legislative process had then happened in subsequent years. However, what is important is that although the legislative amendments followed, the repercussions or the impact or the challenges that had arisen as a result of the amalgamation had remained within the SSA. As a result of this, the President, in the President of the Republic of Africa, President of the Republic of Africa, in 2018, then created a high-level review panel with the intended aim of, one, restructuring a professional intelligence service that would speak or would be in adherence to the Constitution, and we want to underpin this point, to the Constitution and the laws of the land. The culmination of the work of the high-level review panel came up with critical recommendations which sought to reform the intelligence services. Now, Chairperson, it's here that we'd want to really anchor the points, because it's these recommendations precipitate the creation of the bill. So the high-level review panel recommends, one, the separation of a foreign service and a domestic service, emphasis on maximum independence from each other with minimum shared services, if at all. That serious attention be given to more precise, more focused definition and mandate of any resulting service and other sections of the broader intelligence community. Chairperson then further said that the current legislative provisions should be revised concerning the minister's power as it relates to the administration of the service, that you develop clear definitions relating to to legal orders as they apply in the intelligence environment, and specifically then to the IGI and to NICOC, that NICOC should be relocated into the presidency to give it its necessary compliance, but also then independence. Then speaking to the IGI was that the reforms or the provisions that were given to the IGI from previous commissions, that emanated from previous commissions, and here they're speaking about the ministerial position or the Matthews Commission of 2008, that those recommendations then be given effect. So Chairperson, in seeking to implement these recommendations, we then see the Minister and the Presidency drafting a bill called the General Intelligence Laws Amendment Bill, which seeks in the main to amend three pieces of legislation. One, the National Strategic Intelligence Act, Act 39 of 1994, the Intelligence Services Act, Act 65 of 2002, the Intelligence Oversight Act, Act 40 of 1999, and other relevant legislation. So it's not a closed list, Chairperson. And essentially what the SSA then seeks to achieve by this is to, one, align amend or undo the establishment of the SSA in line with the recommendation of the High Level Review Panel, to establish in the subsequent agencies, which is one they call the South African Intelligence Agency as well as the South African Intelligence Service, both having, irrespectively, having a foreign and a domestic focus, to clarify the mandates of the resulting service, to re-establish the South African National Academy of Intelligence, and to provide a legislative mandate for bulk interception in compliance with the Constitutional Court judgment, and then provide regulatory framework in compliance with monitoring, coordination, and alignment of intelligence activities, provide regulations for cyber intelligence, as well. So, Chairperson, we then go to Part A. So that becomes the background and the context in which we see this bill being presented. So we then come to Part A, Chairperson, which speaks to the stakeholder engagement that the committee had. So between 5th and 7th of December, the committee then engaged critical stakeholders within the sector, NICOC, SAPCI, as well as the IGI. From NICOC, Chairperson, and I'm on page 5, the coordinator of NICOC first starts off by telling the committee that NICOC plays an integral role in the value chain, in the intelligence value chain, as it provides strategic intelligence to decision makers on government policy direction. So its work shapes the policy direction of government. One, however, in its current formulation, it's finding a challenge in the sense that its independence and functioning have been hampered. How have they been hampered? The coordinator is fostered by telling, expressing to the committee that one, the current configuration is that NICOC is a cost center or a spending center, beg your pardon, in the SSA. This means that the SSA determines its budget. It determines its budget year to year. It's not predetermined. And then secondly, is that it's responsible, the Minister of the Intelligence Service is responsible for the overall superintendence and control of the people, of the National Intelligence Board of NICOC. Essentially, she, as a minister, is responsible for staffing, resourcing, and any other issues that happen within NICOC. Now, the coordinator had mentioned that this has happened on the effectiveness because at many a times they are unable to make critical decisions around their work, and often had, let's call them, disagreements or differing views on certain issues of staffing and resourcing. NICOC then forthright asked the committee that they are seeking independence. And how they're seeking independence is three matters. One, they would like to determine, or the coordinator to determine, the organizational structure of NICOC. In other words, he should have a say on what and how, of the nature and form of NICOC. Second is that the appropriation of NICOC should happen through an act of parliament. The third one, and this would then help them to reinforce their budget, but also give them the necessary safeguards and insulate them from any other influence that may happen in terms of their budgeting. The third, they ask is that the functions of NICOC be protected. What they've seen happen in the current provisions of GLAB is that the agency would then be able to speak to or provide on a periodic basis, provide briefings on counterintelligence or issues around intelligence services. And they're saying this is the role of a coordinator, this is the role of NICOC. So, Chairperson, they then go on to speak to specific clause and then amend or propose amendments to specific clause. And, Chairperson, that happens on page 6 and page 7 of the presentation, of the report. And if we look then on page 9 of the presentation, we then see SAPS crime intelligence of input. SAPS crime intelligence input really centered on technical drafting input. So first they agreed and supported the bill in the main. Secondly, they then mentioned that there were technical drafting issues that needed to be dealt with. One is the incision of the definition of cybersecurity, but also then said that they're unclear how this definition that is proposed is going to then impact on the bill that is happening through the Department of Justice and Correctional Service, on constitutional development, and that there needed to be a synergy and congruence so that you're not overlapping or you're not creating duplicate mandates or duplicate definitions in different pieces of legislation. The next thing they asked that, the next was the syntax, and they're saying that the definitions of domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence are incongruent, so there needs to be some sort of similarity in terms of the framing and the writing, the technical writing of those definitions. The next was security competency test. They're saying the term assessment should be rather used for consistency throughout the bill. Then Chairperson, we then move over to the Inspector General of Intelligence. Chairperson, the Inspector General of Intelligence submission, really, he started off by informing the committee to say, firstly, intelligence services operate mainly in secret and have extensive and intrusive powers. Now, recognizing this, the Constitution is sought to balance transparency and secrecy by providing or creating an ombudsman or oversight ombudsman called the Inspector General of Intelligence. Now, this role was created such that it would oversee the intelligence services and ensure adherence to the Constitution, the laws of the land, as well as internal policies. Now, however, they're saying this is their role. So in nature and form, they are an independent oversight role, holding intelligence services accountable. Yet they find themselves in a situation where administratively and functionally they are within an intelligence service, specifically within the State Security Agency. They too feel that this current institutional and administrative configuration is making them subordinate to the services and beholden on the service. And as a result, it hampers on the effectiveness and independence of the IGI. They draw reference here to case law, for instance, in Glenister 2, where they speak about, it was the McBride case, where they speak about the fact that the IGI ought to be independent, it ought to be seen, the independence ought to be real and perceived. So it's important that its role ought to, at all material times, be seen as to be independent. They also then make key recommendations, Chairperson. If we look in the report from page 12 all the way to page 17, they detail clause by clause how they would wish to input into the bill. But suffice to say, perhaps as an overview, is that one, the definitions, they input into the definitions of the functions of the IGI. So you see the definitions of review and monitoring, which is the key terms, the key functions of the IGI being inserted into the bill to clarify their work and to delineate their work. The next issue we're seeing is that they ask that the findings and recommendations of the IGI be made binding. They then put a clause on that. They make an insertion for the JSCI, the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, to be able to request the IGI to do certain tasks of oversight, as the JSCI has a limitation on the scope in which it can then interface with intelligence services. They also then ask that the IGI have full superintendence and control on the functioning of the Office of the Inspector General of Intelligence in order to determine its operational grading for the functioning of the IGI. Again, it also then speaks to the reinforcing and earmarking of funds of the IGI, again reinforcing the fact that they need to be independent. Chairperson, I'll then skip forward because those are the main points raised by the IGI. I'll then skip forward if the committee may, where we deal with the public hearing, so issues coming from the public hearing. Chairperson, the committee then has decided to conduct public hearings in 5 provinces. Those are Limpopo, Gauteng, Western Cape, KZN, and Mpumalanga. These happened between January and February of 2024. And Chairperson, in these provinces, it must be noted that the committee had targeted two district municipalities, and within those district municipalities, one local municipality then played host to these provincial public hearings. The approach, so what informed the approach? You'd note that many of these provinces were borderlying, or many of the provinces had borders, and many of the towns were borderlying towns. The approach was informed by the fact that intelligence plays a pivotal role in the development of security of nations, particularly in borderline towns. for developing nations a robust intelligence service serves as a critical tool for safeguarding national security, for safeguarding national interests, promoting economic growth, and ensuring political stability. In border areas where potential security threats are pronounced, intelligence becomes even more critical. It provides essential insights into cross-border activities, helps identify and address security challenges, and facilitates effective border control measures along with other government agencies. So the going to borderline towns or border adjacent towns was informed by this decision check system. The committee then went to, on page 23, Chairperson, we then detail the program of the committee. And then at the bottom, we then say that the planning and successful execution of the public hearings was really resting on the establishment of a core team. This team was made up of community support personnel, along with the health and safety unit, the protection services unit, public education, public relations, media, broadcasting, and household. The combined services of these units ensured that public hearings in identified municipalities were conducted in adherence with Parliament's public participation framework. Now, in the next pages, Chairperson, we then detail how each unit, the role of each unit in the public hearings. We then provide as well the statistical analysis on how many people participated at these public hearings, at the respective public hearings, the submissions that were made. Then taking it even further to in those in support, those against the bill, those who showed partial support of the bill, and those also, Chairperson, who then showed no indication of the bill. Chairperson, this is where then I'd ask the indulgence to then skip ahead, because the next, from page 27 to all the way to page 20, I beg your pardon, all the way to page 41, Chairperson, we have then gone into detail about the overview of public hearings per province. We detail the general observation of the public hearing process. We detail the summary of the inputs, as well as the analysis of the inputs in each public hearing. That's what we do. So we then jump ahead, Chairperson, because that's what we then did. Mm-hmm. Okay. Chairperson, I'd like to then skip ahead to page 42, if I may. If I may, Chairperson, in page 42, we then speak about emanating from this public hearing, Chairperson, specifically the public hearing, for my section would be the public hearings as well as the input from the stakeholders. Emanating from these, Chairperson, we found that there were broad themes that had happened, that had come out of these, or broad or recurring amendments that were identified during these public hearings. Specifically, one was the broad and ambiguous definitions, two, the issue or the provision spoken to on apprehension, security vetting, bulk interception, the independence and powers of the IGI, and the independence of the NUCOS. Chairperson, specifically, I'll talk to page 42 onwards, if I may. If I may, Chairperson, so from page 32, when we speak about broad manners, so the input that can come in terms of the broad and ambiguous definitions, Chairperson, is that participants repetitively stated that the definitions depart from the fundamental values and intentions of the Constitution by directly infringing on several constitutional rights. Of concern was the right to privacy. They stated that the state is constitutionally obligated to respect and protect and promote the Bill of Rights. Should it seek to limit these rights, Chairperson, it ought to do so in adherence to Section 36 of the Constitution. This section, Chairperson, is a limitation clause and lays out a test that ought to be met if you're going to then limit these clauses. If I may, Chairperson, when our legal advisor at the end speaks to some of the issues that have come up in terms of constitutionality, may I ask him to then just note some of these issues that he can then expand on.
I see Honorable Hathaway is not so much satisfied about only referring to the chairperson. No other chairperson and members.
To the Honorable Committee, I beg your pardon.
Doesn't matter.
I beg your pardon. I guess it's because I'm facing the chairperson. Maybe if I move on, I beg your pardon for that, chair and members. The committee would then remember that. Oh, so that was the issue that was raised as respect to the limitations of that. Third thing that was raised, chairperson, regarding to the definitions was the fact that the definition seemed to be broad and overly ambiguous, which allowed for misinterpretation and abuse. What was then raised was that the definitions were not clear and ambiguous, but actually what they were doing was that they were circular. They were circular because the definitions, the terms used to describe a definition were part of the definition, which further highlighted the ambiguity of these definitions. Another issue then that came up, Jefferson, was the fact that concern was raised that the definitions are broad and ambiguous, but further to that, these definitions then inform the day-to-day work and operations of the intelligence services, which became of critical concern when then applying these definitions to the vetting mandate. The broad definitions, again, then was in an insights or participants highlighted the fact that the broad definitions were also against what the high-level review panel had called for. The high-level review panel had called for definitions to be narrowed, definitions to ensure that they're precise and that they're focused. Emanating from these engagements, I beg your pardon, was that there were proposed provisions given on how to draft each and every definition that was deemed as problematic. The next issue, Honourable Committee, that came into the fore was the fact that the provisions within the bill speak, there's a provision in the bill that speaks to apprehension. So submissions were then said to say, various submissions raised this point regarding the misunderstanding of the term apprehension by the general public. So the general public was equating apprehension to arrest, and this was not accurate because apprehension speaks to being done in a prescribed manner, and it would then be, after people being apprehended, would then be taken to the relevant law enforcing agencies. However, arrests, chairperson, are done under Section 835 of the bill. In other words, when you arrest somebody, you immediately draw the provisions of Section 35 of the Constitution, which speak to the right to remain silent, the right to access of bail, and a fair trial. So all those protections a person gets, which is unclear in this particular bill, how a person is going to be then protected in the right of protection, particularly because they say that apprehension will be done in a prescribed manner, which then speaks to regulations, and regulations are then done at a ministerial level, and then we then know that that means that within the SSA, that is a closed process. So those were then the issues as it relates to apprehension. The proposal that came forth from the public hearings was that removed this provision from the bill altogether. Vetting, security vetting, a key issue that came up from public hearings was that, and I'm on page 46, Honourable Members, was that vetting, security vetting one, the high-level review panel had recommended that there be a review of the overall mandate of vetting investigations, in other words, that it needs to be redone to balance out the given obligation of consideration. But moreover, coming from this, there must be a nuanced vetting approach that is leaner and more focused. However, what we're seeing in the current bill, or what participants deemed as problematic with the bill, was the fact that it had expanded the vetting mandate. Now, if you look at, for instance, input raised, said that inputs were made that the proposed provisions in the bill break with the wide definitions of national security, threat to national security, and a person or institution of national security interest, provide the effect that those clauses could be that even religious organizations and civic organizations, their leaders and employees and members, are seen as persons of interest or institutions of national security interest. Now, Chairperson, what was critical here was that it was also unclear from the bill what the consequence would be should these institutions or persons be denied security clearance. The third thing that honourable members are really proud of that came out from public hearings was that careful consideration must be given to the recourse that would happen in an event that a person was not given a security clearance. Further to that was the fact that the high-level review panel recommended that security vetting be restricted to individuals working with classified information, as existing backlogs already exist with the vetting within the vetting environment. Now, the inclusion of the provisions for vetting investigations on persons or institutions of national security raised concerns, as it seems to conflate vetting with a criminal investigation or intelligence assessment, which it is not. Thus, recommendations were then set to say that the bill or the crafting of that provision be redone to read as follows, as stipulated on page 47 and page 48. We move then to page 48, where input came in on bulk interception. Chairperson, bulk interception, the main concern was as follows. It was said that bulk interception, although necessary for national security and counterterrorism efforts, there were concerns about the potential abuse and infringement of privacy rights. The indiscriminate nature of bulk interception means that it can capture data of innocent individuals, undermining the principles of privacy, freedom of speech, and due process. In this regard, it then raises two issues. One, what are the legal provisions to do this? But secondly, what are the safeguards to ensure that people who are innocent and are not a target of these investigations are then ensured, the privacy is then ensured? A lot of participants then said, in order to ensure that bulk surveillance is has the necessary safeguards, they recommended that the constitutional judgment and the provisions that were set in there be implemented in their full nature. The dots in, or the bullets stipulated on page 48, in terms of safeguarding, perhaps let me just detail what they are. The Constitutional Court set out that the law must ensure the following: safeguard the independence of the specially designated judge in issuing interception warrants, compensate for the fact that one cannot defend oneself when state intelligence agencies apply for surveillance warrants, since the surveillance is sought in secret, create protections when the surveillance is just, create the protections when surveillance is for lawyers or journalists, and or leave those professions out. Better regulate the storage and deleting of the intercepted communications. And I guess the next one is also then one that was raised quite clear and quite strongly, was that there must be some sort of post-notification that happens once interception has been conducted. As long, and this is I think the disclaimer, as the notification does not jeopardize any ongoing investigations. The next 5.5, Chairperson, input that was made, honourable members, I mean your comment that was raised, was the independence of the IGI. Chairperson, several inputs came through on the independence of the IGI. First was the fact that the IGI must be independent and real or perceived independence must occur. Second was that the necessary safeguards must be built in to ensure that ministerial or executive overreach does not happen in the duties of the IGI. The third, Chairperson, was that the IGI must or ought to be given overall superintendence and control of the functioning of his office, and that the funding of the IGI, of the office of the IGI, must be ring-fenced and insulated from the SSA or the agency, that the findings or his findings must be binding, such to ensure that full compliance with the Constitution and the law and that intelligence services are truly then held accountable. And that repeated calls came to say that the IGI's recommendations or the IGI's input, as dealt with earlier, be fully then included and considered as they are in the bill check system. Honourable members. The next point, Chairperson, as it relates to NICOC, similar to that of the IGI, was that one participant highlighted the importance of effective intelligence coordination. Specifically, this came out in border towns such as KZN, as well as Gauteng, who had experienced the issues that came as a result of the July 2021 unrest and the lack of perceived lack of coordination there. So they reinforced and really buttressed the fact that the NICOC ought to be really strengthened and its role pronounced. Secondly, participation stressed that NICOC's mandate must be protected and strengthened, and that NICOC must be supplied with all the intelligence that is needed, and that it must be the one that coordinates all intelligence for strategic purposes. The third issue that came about is that the coordinator of NICOC must have overall superintendence and control of the office for effective functioning on execution of these duties. And that finally, Chairperson, that the funding and the funding of NICOC must be ring-fenced to ensure that it is used for its purpose. Chairperson, finally then we get to matters. There were many matters that came about from the public hearing that didn't directly impact the bill. Members would remember that during these public hearings, there were many issues that came out that were of social security issues, specifically dealing with the triple threat of unemployment, inequality, and poverty, honourable members. Now, all these inputs have been collated and will then be disseminated into or sent through to the relevant portfolio committees for follow-up or oversight over them. Another issue that came out quite strongly was that calls for clauses that refer to torture be removed from the bill. It must be be removed from the bill, or any perceived sense of torture be removed from the bill. The other issue that came out quite strongly was the fact that former members of the National Intelligence Services who may still be within the State Security Agency or any other intelligence service must be removed, I think is the word, there must be a phasing out of influences that aren't necessarily, or people who don't harbour democratic allegiance or alliance. And then also, Chairperson, that employment and opportunities be given to all people, including those who have disabilities and living with disabilities, particularly within the intelligence services. Again, Chairperson, we then say that all these inputs have been collated and are then going to be sent through to the relevant portfolio committee. Honourable members, I submit my part.
Thank you very much. I think we can continue.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair and members. I will be taking you through the next two sections of the report, Part C. The next two sections deal with the oral submissions, national hearings, oral submissions, and the longer part will deal with the written submissions received. Again, the page is page 51 of the printout document. So part C deals with the oral submissions. I will follow the same line as Nomulelo did in guiding you through the document and perhaps not going into all the details, or just offer a guide through the document and how we put it together. In terms of the oral submissions, during the written submission process, there were several requests for oral submissions to be made to this committee, and the committee proceeded to this and ultimately held a series of oral hearings on the 20th and 21st of February 2024. On the 20th, the entities that presented, or individuals that presented, were the FW Flag Foundation, the Association of Christian Media, AfriForum, Kusatu, and on the next day we had Prof. Dintwe, Freedom of Religion South Africa, Dear South Africa, Intel Watch, and Professor Jane Duncan. The section 2 there, the overview of proceedings, here we, what we did in this following sections is to provide a broad overview of the submissions that were made by these individuals and organizations. So on page 51 and 52, firstly, the oral submissions by the FW de Klerk Foundation, and they mainly raised three issues. And you'll see as we go through this and part D of this document, there's a golden thread running through this document of issues raised. For example, in the FW de Klerk Foundation submission, the three main issues that they raised were around definitions, issues around compulsory vetting, and what they call the disregard for the constitutional court judgment regarding bulk interception. In terms of the definitions they raised, two key definitions that promised were the definitions of national security and the definition around opportunity or potential opportunity. And again, they pointed out that these were circular in reference. And therefore, on page 52, they made a number of recommendations, and we kept it in this format, members, that yes, while this is a report on the public participation process, we kept it in this format to also assist the committee when you deliberate on these matters clause by clause. You can easily refer to these tables and see what the different inputs were during the different parts of the public participation process. So the next two pages, up to page 53, deals with their proposals in terms of the definitions that they identified as problematic. The next area that they focused on was the issue around vetting. And they argued that the criteria for such institutions that needed to be vetted under the new bill was unclear, and crucially, that this provision could be abused. So again, they made a number of recommendations there. On the next page, on page 54. The next section that they identified as problematic was the failure to comply with the Constitutional Court ruling, and specifically they mentioned the issue here of post-surveillance notification that were not provided for in the bill. Then on to section 3.2 on page 54, dealt with the submission by the Association of Christian Media. The key issues that they raised were the vagueness of definitions, coming up again, as well as issues around oversight and specifically the need to strengthen the powers of the IGI. Number 3.3 dealt with the input from AfriForum. Key issues raised by them was concern around the expansion of vetting powers, and they raised fundamental issues with human rights and privacy, rights of privacy and freedom of association. I think Nomalena already referred to that in terms of the constitutional directives in that matter. Number 3.4 deals with the inputs from Kusatu. Kusatu noted specifically the oversight role of the IGI, and it was concerns around the IGI and issues around checks and balances on bulk interception. That were their main problem areas identified in the bill. And then a bit down the line, Kusatu made a number of recommendations in terms of the definitions. So they also identified definitions as a problem area in this bill. And they made a number of recommendations towards the end on page 56 for the committee to consider. Then Prof. Dintwe on page 56. Issues raised here was around independence of civilian oversight and the need for independent civilian oversight. as well as the need in that realm, the need to strengthen measures concerning the non-implementation of the IGI's recommendations. Furthermore, the issue around resource allocation issues, and Prof. Intwe noted that this should be done through Act of Parliament, akin to models such as the Public Protector and IPED. Number 3.6, that was on the next day, on page 57, deals with the inputs from Freedom of Religion South Africa. The main concern that they raised was that the vetting process could potentially categorize religious institutions as threats to national security. And in that sense, you can follow the bullets there on page 57. They made a number of recommendations which largely deal with the issues around definitions which they view as problematic again. On page 58, Intel Watch, they started off by noting that they were of the view that splitting the SSA into two services, in doing this, the bill did not do enough to address the findings of several investigative bodies, such as the High Level Review Panel and the Judicial Commission of Inquiry into Allegations of State Capture. Other problem areas that Intel Watch identified included, again, the definitions, and they list a number of definitions there, and then the issue around the IGI, which they noted needs to be financially independent, and they again claimed that, or highlighted the issues around the need for binding recommendations from the Inspector General of Intelligence. That is towards the end on page 59. The next input summarized here was from Prof. Jane Duncan. That is on page 59 of your printout. Prof. Jane Duncan pointed out a number of issues, and we'll get to more specifics on her input in the later stages. But issues raised by her include the issues around definitions, issues around the fact that vetting was recommended to be restricted to individuals working with classified documents, that she noted. She also pointed out issues around the process of bulk interception. And lastly, on page 60, she notes that NICOC required more independent organizational status. So you can already see, again, a thread of issues coming through in line with the public hearings and stakeholder engagements as well. If you look at all this that was provided during this oral submission, there's a number of key issues that come out here, and those are presented in a short format on page 60. The key issues arising here are problems around definitions that were raised by members of organizations and individuals during the oral submission. So definitions, number one, compulsory vetting issues, and compliance with constitutional court ruling. Those are just the key issues we try to highlight here. It's not all the issues, and that's why we kept it in the document so you can refer back to this and see the a bit more detail. But these are the key threats that emerged during oral submissions, among others. Then on to page 61, we get to the committee report on the written submissions. Just in terms of the introduction, we highlighted the process that it was advertised, the call for written submissions advertised in 11 official languages, and the submissions were open from 15 December to 30 January 2024. There was then a call, the committee received at least 13 written submissions requesting an extension of the deadline, and as members will recall, Chair, there was a review of this, and a decision was made to provide for this extension up to the 15th of February 2024. So an additional 2 weeks were provided for written input. In total during this period, and we'll get to the breakdown of this, but the committee received 23,502 written submissions on the bill. Section 2 there on page 61 refers to the advertising of the bill. It was advertised for written comment on a number of platforms, including newspapers, which we'll provide a breakdown of, Parliament's website, and all Parliament social media accounts, including Facebook, formerly X, formerly Twitter, as well as Instagram. If you then move to the bottom of page 61, you will see the in which newspapers these ads for written submissions were placed, and it was in all 11 official languages. Then section 3 on page 62 talks about the public submissions received. And I think this is an important distinction to make, the breakdown of how we categorize it for you in this document. So the committee received 23,502 written submissions on the bill during the prescribed period. And this can be viewed in two categories. Firstly, the vast majority, 99.2% of the submissions received, were submitted via the platform Dear South Africa. That is why we also felt it important for Dear South Africa to brief the committee on the submissions from their side and the submissions that were submitted through their online platform. So the vast majority were received through Dear South Africa. But in addition to that, if you take away the Dear South Africa submissions, we're left with another 176 submissions that were made to the committee, of which 26 of these were very substantive submissions, and we'll get to that now. But in section 3.1 there, we look at submissions via the Dear South Africa platform. And the Dear South Africa platform, members were briefed on this by Dear South Africa, but it allows for you to go on their online platform and raise your opinion about the bill, whether you support the bill or not. And importantly, if you don't support the bill, it auto-generates a number of responses as to why you might not wish to support the bill. If you look at those auto-generated responses, in the four bullet points, on page 62, it includes the reasons that you can select from it: mass surveillance of all South African communities, my right to privacy, other or no concern. So those are the key areas where you can that you can click. It does allow for further comment. Once you click one of those options, it allows for further comment, and you can submit your specific input into the bill on their online platform. However, the majority of submissions that were received through the Dear South Africa platform used the prescribed concern and didn't necessarily provide substantive input into the bill. However, if you look at the breakdown of all of these submissions, 23,326 of them, of that, the vast majority, 22,736, did not support the bill. 401 submissions is not fully supportable, and 189 submissions support the bill. And if you go to page 64, just to go down a little bit, there is a graph that shows you what people viewed as the main objections to the bill, and the percentage of that. And you can see the majority of it relates to concerns around my right to privacy, as well as state security vetting of private individuals, non-profit organizations, religious organizations, or businesses. So where does this leave the committee in terms of the submissions through Dear South Africa? Just above the chart there at the bottom of page 63, just page one back, the key issues that emerged from this and how we used it in this report is, first of all, the committee should note that there was general opposition to the bill on its current form through the Dear South Africa platform. The vast majority of submissions through Dear South Africa did not support the bill. How we used the information then was that the auto-generated responses that were most cited as problematic were contained in the clause-by-clause analysis that is to come in this part of the report. And where people through Dear South Africa provided substantive submissions, where they refer to specific clauses or specific aspects, we also included that in the clause-by-clause analysis that is to come. So we did not disregard specific inputs by Dear South Africa. It was taken into account, and we included that in the clause-by-clause analysis to come. Then if you move on to page 64, here we provide a breakdown of written submissions received that exclude Dear South Africa. And of these, there were 176 submissions received. And the table there, table one, provides the different categories or a breakdown of this 176. And 13 of this 176 submissions requested a deadline. That was the only aim of that submission, was to request a deadline, which the committee adhered to, by providing 2 extra weeks to participate. 26 had a full substantive submission, and with this we mean there were specific references to specific clauses in the bill with specific focus areas. 30 of these was a repeat submission by faith-based definition, faith-based institutions on the definitions of the bill. So we did not disregard that, we just categorized it as one because it was the same form that was submitted by 30 different organizations raising the same issues. There were also 25 emails that was empty or undelivered, or there's something, or that didn't relate to this bill at all, that was actually a submission on another bill. Most of this referred to the Bella bill. Then 70 of the submissions was opposition to the bill, but without substantive input. It was merely an email we received saying, I do not support the bill. No specific reference to the clause in the bill. So that was just 70 of those, and there were also 2 emails that supported the bill, but also again without substantive input. And then 10 of them were partially substantive inputs, where the committee can't ignore these, but it had limited input to specific clauses, and we did include that in the clause-by-clause breakdown that is to come. Then the next table 2, provides for a breakdown of the 26 organizations that provided full substantive written submissions. And some of these institutions and individuals were invited for the stakeholder engagements and partook in that process. So there might be an overlap between what you read here and what they presented on that day, but not all of them. So we included this list for you to review of all organizations and individuals that provided a full substantive written submissions. Then on page 66 at the top there, you see the methodology and analysis. So the next sections that are to follow, and I think hopefully this provides members with a valuable guide as you go through deliberations. It's quite lengthy to come, but the next sections provide a clause-by-clause summary based on the written submissions. And I think it's important to know that this is a summary. It is not everything that was submitted during the written submissions. But we try to capture the essence of what organizations said by using their own words and allocating to the right clause. So there are 2 approaches we followed. If an institution or individual submitted concerns around a specific clause, we would include it in that clause. And if there was a general concern raised by an institution or an individual, then we used our judgment to allocate it to the correct clause so that members can use it in your deliberation. So therefore, if you moved it down down that page on page 66, we then do the clause-by-clause summary of the written submission. And as you can see in the table there, we used the organization that submitted it and what were their specific comments. So the first clause, the main issue was around, clause one deals with definitions, and there were a number of submissions in this regard. Members will go through this and can go through this and use this in your deliberations. I'm not going to go through the entire section. Suffice to say, if you go to the submission of, say, on page 67, the submission of Prof. James Duncan, that provides a neat summary of the key definitions that people generally have problems with. The definitions of came up repeatedly that was of most concern include definitions of domestic intelligence, foreign intelligence, intelligence gathering, national security intelligence, opportunity and potential opportunity, and threat to national security. Those are the ones that repeatedly came to the fore. So from page 66 up into page, get the right page here. Up until page 81 of your document, that all deals with submissions on definitions. So And there's a lot of repeat in these submissions, but we felt it of need to highlight the different definitions. There are also a number of recommendations that for alternative definitions that were submitted by members of the public. Then on page 81, we do have the clause 2 that deals with the functions. Just want to get to the right scope. On page 81, clause 2 deals with the functions and outlines the functions of the agency, the service, and the center. Again, there's a number of issues here that specifically relates to the functions of the National Communication Center. And we again highlight those issues right during the written submission. Members can see, for example, on page 82, a submission by Razia Razin and Nanette Tolton, we included a note there that no reference to a specific clause was made, but the below has reference to clause 2 of the bill. So we just highlight that in italics there for members to know that these submissions from these individuals didn't necessarily mention clause 2, but their input has relevance to clause 2. And the main theme, again, that emerged here in this section of the public submissions relates to the issue of the National Communication Center and the issue of bulk surveillance. Then on page 85, we move to the issue around the security competence assessment. And there were a number of submissions in this regard as well. And this correlates strongly with the issues around the definitions, where there were a lot of problems identified by institutions and individuals around what is considered to be a person of or institution of national interest and how that then relates to the issue around security vetting. That carries on from page 85
to
92. As you can see, these first ones, especially around definitions, vetting, and the issue of the National Communications Center, that really provides the bulk of the report at this stage. Then if you move to page 92, it deals with clause 4, amendment, which is amendments to clause 3. The only submission that was received here was from the Department of Defense. So members might wish to look at this. The submission from the Department of Defense here is here that there is a limitation placed on the SANDF not to gather intelligence of a non-military nature in a covert manner, and this prevents the SANDF from fully executing its constitutional mandate to ensure national security. And this is for the committee to consider during deliberations as to whether this is in fact the case and whether this bill is the best place to address such a matter, and whether it is a true shortcoming, that is for the committee to consider. Perhaps just another aspect to consider on page 92, there's the DoD made a recommendation on the national they made a recommendation on section 3.1 of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, where they say other than the National Defense Force when employed for the service referred to in section 227 of the Constitution, or when discharging the counterintelligence responsibilities entrusted to its intelligence division. The submission by the DoD made specific reference to the need to collect intelligence when they are deployed in terms of the Constitution. Should members find that this is an important aspect to cover in this bill, in the footnote there, we included that the SANDF can be deployed in terms of the Constitution domestically, but it can also be employed in terms of the Defense Act domestically by the Minister of Defense. That is allowed for in legislation. The submissions from the Department of Defense didn't include any reference to deployments through the Defence Act. So perhaps that is for now. If the committee wishes to indulge it and wishes to dive into this collection capabilities during domestic deployments, perhaps looking at their deployments under the Constitution and under the Defence Act is crucial. We then move on to page 96, which is clause 5 that relates to NICOC, and there we had some input from, 94, the input on NICOC. There was limited input but specifically by Professor Jane Duncan, that again highlighted, as she did in her oral submission, that NICOC is an entity that needs to be given more of an independent organizational status. Then the next clause, also on page 94, ministerial regulations. There was some input by Freedom Under Law and the Ahmed Katran Foundation, which notes that the bill fails to stipulate a reporting requirement in terms of which public organizations who have been subject of a cyber attack are required to disclose this fact to the public in accordance with international best practice. They noted that, so there's been some issues around that, as well as another input from the Department of Defense. Then, clause 11 on page 95 and 96. Clause 11, as members may have seen from the previous input, this relates to the Inspector General's office, and there were a number of inputs, written inputs received up until page 97. Yes, up until page 97. That relates to the issues around the Inspector General's office. And the key issues again here is around the independence of the Inspector General's office. Professor Jane Duncan noting that it requires its own infrastructure and budget, its own organizational structure, more powers around the appointment of staff, unmediated access to intelligence information, and the need for the position of a Deputy Inspector General to be created. And most comments here followed the same trajectory around the issue of the Inspector General and calling for Inspector General's office's independence. Then clause 16, which is on page 97 up to page and follows on page 98, this also relates to the issue around bulk surveillance and the establishment of the National Communications Center. And the key issue here was, as was noted earlier, is compliance with the Constitutional Court judgment. And this is a theme that emerges again and again in this section. Up to page 103, members can note that this is the issue around the Constitutional Court judgment is repeated in this written submission. Another theme that flows through this is the whole issue about the right to privacy and the constitutional matters around the right to privacy. So up to page 103, it deals with issues around the National Communications Center and specifically issues around right to privacy. As you can see on the last section there, on the top of page 103, we for example highlighted that 15,916 submissions that were submitted through Dear South Africa highlighted the issue around my right to privacy and concerns around mass surveillance of all South Africans. So I think that's a key area where it helps to highlight what the Dear South Africa submission said and the number of people that raised concern specifically on that issue and how it relates then to this clause 16 of the bill. Clause 18 of the bill is around the Intelligence Academy. There's an interesting submission from Transnet, Michelle Phillips at Transnet, noting that the draft bill may create bias in the agency as opposed to the service. As a result, consideration should be given to having a reporting line to be directly to the minister. And then there's a recommendation there that follows from Transnet. Then clause 23, so on page 103, there's a submission specifically on this clause only by Professor Jane Duncan. And the key aspect she raises here is that Section 23, as it's currently stated in the bill, is merely a restatement of a problematic section in the Intelligence Services Act. And she notes that this provision should be amended to ensure that the minister is confined to executive oversight. That's the key point she raised there. Then on the next page, clause 45, there was a submission by the Department of Defense. This is merely a correction in their view of the wording, where the current, the bill notes the event of war, and they say that that is not the correct wording, but it should rather read the state of national defense. And lastly, on page 104, there was one written submission relating to the classification of the bill, and that was around the traditional leadership. That was not consulted, but I do think this is addressed in the bill. There was a reference to why it's not necessary to actually consult traditional leadership council in this process. Then the last section here on page 105 of your document relates to other matters raised in the written submission. Matters that didn't specifically speak to a clause or a specific clause in the bill, but these are issues that for the committee to grapple further with during the deliberations. And there's some repeat in this section as well. So freedom under law and the Ahmed Katrada Foundation noted, for example, the abuse of secret funds. That was one of the issues that comes up a number of times, and claiming that the bill in its current form doesn't make enough or doesn't do enough in preventing the abuse of secret funds within the intelligence agency. Secondly, it was noted that the bill does not specify any offence or sanction for being classified as a threat to national security. Professor Jane Duncan noted that this bill was developed in the absence of a revised national security strategy, and this is quite an anomaly that there was actually a need for a national security strategy prior to processing this bill, and that point was repeated later by another academic. We'll get to him as well. She also noted that, again, the governance of the Secret Service accounts, same as the freedom under law, she also noted that issue around the Secret Service accounts. The next one by Sir Malan Foster was a long submission, I think through Dear South Africa, if I recall. It was a long submission, noted that this bill violates a number of constitutional directives. We included all of them there. I think, suffice to say, and Nobulela noted this as an earlier concern as well from other platforms, is to ensure constitutional muster, to ensure that none of these sections in the Constitution, or that the bill didn't go against any of these sections in the Constitution. Amo Bungane also provided on page 107, provided input specifically around the issue, as we can expect, around bulk surveillance, as well as this need for the appointment of independent intelligence officials, creating of effective oversight mechanisms. Issues around the safeguarding of secret funds comes up again, and the need for the IGI and the Joint Planning Committee on Intelligence that are hampered by a lack of budget, and they need to control their budget more independently. The FW de Klerk Foundation, they also, that is on page 108, they also noted the issue around constitutional rights that are being infringed by the bill in its current form, so it comes back to the previous point raised around constitutional muster. Intel Watch raised a number of additional points, specifically that in the benchmark studies that are used, they pointed out that it must be noted that in the United Kingdom, the UK security vetting is a body that is separate from the security services. So they highlighted that as a point to note. They also, again, called for measures to prevent interference by the minister that should be included in the bill, measures to give adequate access to and top security clearances to certain staff of the Auditor General. This is a point I raised as well. And enhanced oversight by the IGI, the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence, as well as the Auditor General. The campaign for free expression, that is on page 109, they highlighted the issue of secret funds, oversight that is needed. OTA on page 109 raised issues around the constitutionality of the bill, and a lot of the definitions are left open for misinterpretation. That also raised the issue of secret funds. Then there was a number of, at the bottom of page 109 and 110, a number of submissions by Dear South Africa that highlighted the constitutionality of the bill, several sections highlighted again. There was the need for recruitment and training practices to ensure qualified personnel, member of the public, noting the need for the bill to ensure that qualified personnel are attracted to the intelligence services. Privacy International, that is on page 110, raised issues around oversight of the intelligence agencies. Sonke Gender Justice, at the bottom of page 110, raised issues around the public participation process, as did Louise Bick on page 111 around the extension for written submissions, which she claimed was not sufficient. And she also noted the need for the bill to be measured in terms of its constitutional muster again. On the next page, on page 111 here, Freedom of Religion South Africa noted the issue around consequences of failing to obtain a certificate of security clearance. They claim that this is not provided for in the bill and highlighted the need for those consequences to be stipulated in the bill. There were a number of proposals made then by, on page 111 and 112, by Nazuko Pekole, recommendations to the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence, but for consideration of this committee as well. And then Antoni van Niekerk on page 112, basically along the same lines as Professor Jane Duncan, noted the need for an integrated philosophy on national security. And again, that this bill was drafted without the existence of a national security strategy. So that's perhaps something this committee can look at as well, issue around the national security strategy and whether there's a need to legislate for the drafting and regular updating of a national security strategy. Lastly, the Department of Defense noted in their submission as well that this law this bill was largely drafted without the involvement of the Department of Defense, and they were tasked at a very late stage to provide inputs on this bill. You can view those as additional submissions from the Department of Defense submission. So, Chair, members, that brings us to the end of this lengthy report, but we just provide a quick synopsis at the end, or a quick conclusion at the end there, a paragraph conclusion around the methodology that we followed here, and that there's a golden thread that you can follow through all these submissions, actually, not only in the written part, but through all the submissions submitted around the key issues, mostly around the issues of the definitions, vetting, accountability structures such as the IGI. But what I would like to end off with is a reminder that the way we structure this document is, yes, it's a report that can be submitted on the public participation process, but it was drafted in a way to hopefully assist you in your deliberation. When you do clause-by-clause deliberations, you can page back, see the different submissions from individuals and organizations, and view the deliberations against what the members of the public submitted. So we trust that this will assist you and wish you all the best of the deliberation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The process, are we supposed to get clarification, ask you questions, ask you to repeat from the beginning, or what are we supposed to be doing now? Okay, questions?
Use the one on the left.
Thanks very much. I have no idea how I put that on. Thank you. It's not, I don't think, for inclusion in this report. It's just a query in that there were a number of participants in the public hearing who claimed that they had not been informed about the bill. And some of them asked us to run through the bill with them as though that initial step of the initial instruction by a completely separate division of Parliament had perhaps not taken place in some areas or was insufficient, etc. I wonder if it was in our purview as a committee to ask for a report in terms of that division, which is, doesn't fall under us at all, on who exactly they spoke to in terms, for example, when they shifted the venue in Pietermaritzburg, I think it had initially been advertised as being within the city, was then moved to a rural area, and it was quite obvious to all that the very little knowledge of the bill had been available to them. I mean, it was bizarre that they even scooped in EPWP people to the hearing. So I just would like a report perhaps from that entity for our information and how to ensure perhaps a more inclusive process. I think we literally ticked all the boxes in terms of public hearing, but that was an area of concern for me. So I was hoping we could have that looked into. I don't think it's relevant for this report, but I think it's important for the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay,
what's the procedure now?
No, clarifications, maybe questions on the report, or any other thing in relation to the report that you would like to clarify or ask questions?
None from my side, sir.
You will tell me if I'm off-ramping.
You never raised your hand.
I'm still dragging the mic.
Oh. Okay, over to you.
Thank you.
Now, let me take this opportunity, Chair, to welcome comprehensive, useful, and very progressive report. It gives us a sense of where to look and what to look, and issues of concern have been broken down for us for ease of reference. The content advisor, when she started, she went into details about the recommendations of the high-level review panel. And also touch base that there were some sentiments that seeks to suggest that the bill does not fully implement the recommendations in the high level review panel. Hence, I said you will guide me if I'm off-roping. I want you just to get a sense from your understanding and what is currently contained. Would you concur with such a sentiment or not in terms of having looked at the draft, the submissions, and issues of concern noted, if you were to give that advice, would you concur or give a different opinion? So to assist us whether or not we need to, in our deliberation, engage further on certain aspects that were not fully ventilated in the bill. And that question also, I think it's relevant to the legal advisor to say, please members, consider these recommendations as they were not fully or they are partly covered in terms of the bill. That will be my question. question, Chair, if I'm not speaking out of turn. Thank you.
No, I think that's a relevant question. Maybe from my side, the first question, people who are citizens who complain that they never saw or they never knew about the bill, surely the bill was advertised. I mean, the meetings were advertised. And from what the content advisor said, that there must be reasonable, whatever, those terms that...
meaningful and reasonable.
Yeah, that is what the Constitution says. That was my understanding. I would like to ask you your opinion, but what is that reasonable and... Because definitely you can't touch every other person. The 62 million is not possible. That's why they're saying reasonable. How would you explain the reasonable? And some other people maybe were not even interested. It's a bit of a complicated bill for a peasant like my grandmother. She wouldn't definitely be interested because she wouldn't understand. Maybe if you could explain that, the reasonableness. And then... from defense, I think it's your page 92. You have got a footnote on that one. Your feeling, do you think that is covered? What they have within the Defense Act covers what in terms of their deployment? I think the footnote is trying to say that. Maybe the last question, maybe that would be on your page 104. The National Security Strategy. That hasn't been forthcoming for a very long time. Which it is said in the pre or come before the bill. Is it a prerequisite? Or it makes sense, I understand. It makes sense to have that before, I mean, like a white paper before you have the bill, which explains. But it's definitely not a prerequisite, that is my... doesn't say if you don't have that, you can't come up with the bill. Even if it would be very clever to come with the strategy before you come up with the bill. Those are my questions. Over to you. I think the first one would go to the legal advisor in terms of what would be enough, what would be reasonable, what would be, because, I mean, one person can come and say, no, I didn't see your advert. And when you try and send your spies to investigate, you find that he wasn't even in South Africa at that time. How do you... Yeah, I keep on repeating, but I want you to get the weight of my question. Over to you.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, the Constitution in Section 59 only provides that the National Assembly and its committees must facilitate public involvement in the legislative process. That's all the Constitution says.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates a positive obligation on parliamentary committees to facilitate public involvement or promote what is called participatory democracy, where the public or members of the public participate directly in the lawmaking processes of parliament. So that's just the bare requirement of the constitution, Chair.
Mm-hmm.
But the question that you are asking, and I'm understanding you to mean, how do you apply that constitutional obligation in practice?
Mm-hmm.
So we have gotten guidance, Chair, on a number of constitutional court judgments that have considered the matter. As far back, starting as far back as 2006, when the constitutional court considered the Doctors for Life matter,
mm-hmm.
the Land Access Movement matter, New Cliques, as well as Mukhada recently, the judgment on the Khoisan Bill. And consistently throughout these judgments of the Constitutional Court, the courts have said how you give effect to that constitutional obligation is that Parliament must ensure that it gives a reasonable opportunity to members of the public, or it offers them the reasonable opportunity to participate in the lawmaking process. So it is upon Parliament to create circumstances that make it possible, on the standard of reasonability, for members of the public to participate in the lawmaking process. Now, Chair, Parliament has a discretion on how to do this, and the courts themselves have said that deference must be given on Parliament on what to decide, for each to decide on how that, what is the standard of reasonability in its mind, Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So Parliament must apply its mind and decide what it is going to do to give effect to the right or to discharge the obligation of facilitating public participation. However, Chair, the courts have then said they ultimately determine if the matter should be brought before the court, determine if Parliament, in its exercise of its discretion to decide what is public participation, what is the reason for public participation, if it met the constitutional threshold. So the constitutional threshold, Chair, is that of reasonableness. That Parliament must provide a reasonable opportunity for members of the public to participate in the lawmaking process. So in order to give effect to this, Chair, in practice, Parliament has gone to develop what is known as the public participation model, which sets out the actual steps that Parliament must undertake to give effect to this constitutional obligation. And these steps, Chair, have been accepted by the court to be constitutionally compliant, or at least meeting the constitutional threshold of reasonability. I will state this, Chair, for complicity. Number one, Parliament must conduct pre-hearing workshops in order to establish the relationship with the stakeholders who will be participating. Parliament must develop effective communication and awareness programs through advertisements. It must ensure that communities are mobilized so that there are people who attend the public hearing. It must also ensure that there are consultation meetings that are convened between itself as well as the members of the public who will be participating. It must also ensure that summaries of the bill are translated into at least three of the languages spoken in the area where it is consulting. And lastly, transport must be provided for people to come to the actual venue where the consultation will be taking place, or where the public involvement will be taking place. Those, Chair, are the key requirements which have been considered by the courts to be the ones that would assist Parliament to meet the threshold of having facilitated a reasonable, or having provided a reasonable opportunity for the public to participate in this lawmaking process. So that's in relation to that question, Chair. Thank you. So I don't know if you wanted me to also answer the other question by Honourable Hadema.
Mm-hmm.
On the constitutionality issues. Thank you, Chair. So, regarding the constitutionality issues, Chair, we have analyzed the bill and we have not, from a legal perspective, picked up any issues different from those which have already been presented by my colleagues in the public participation report. Amongst those key issues, Chair, are the issues of relating to definitions. We have found that the definitions in the bill are actually too wide, Chair, and they go against what they are intended for, or what is the purpose of definitions in legislation, which is to aid interpretation of the law, and also to clarify terms and concepts that are used in the legislation. We have found that the definitions in the bill are actually substantive and are not constrained as they should be. So that's the first issue relating to definitions. The problem with that share is that it would lead to confusion because there's ambiguity and therefore the unclarity of the legislation, which could potentially also lead to things such as litigation amongst other undesired impacts. And then the issue of compulsory vetting, which has also been spoken to about extensively in the report. Chair, vetting as a practice infringes on rights of persons, particularly the right of privacy. And that the state has the obligation, which is in Section 7, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, to respect, promote, and fulfill the Bill of Rights. And that the manner in which now the issue of compulsory vetting is crafted in the bill doesn't...
Can I be corrected? Am I not overstepping now? I seem to feel that we are deliberating. I think I made a mistake. Today is not the day to deliberate, is it?
No, it's not yet.
Okay. Is it me who made a mistake, or are you making a mistake yourself? Or did the question make a mistake?
The question maker.
No, I'm answering the question. I asked for your guidance on the question.
As you are answering, I tend to feel that we are now deliberating on the which is not today.
Yes.
Supposed to be on Friday.
Yes.
Okay. And the other two questions that I asked, are they not the defense one and the national security strategy? Do they need deliberation, or those can be answered now? It's clarification, I should say. Can we leave that one and get the two? Sorry about that.
That is awesome.
Oh, thank you. Perhaps maybe I'll start with Honorable Hadeben's question, which was, were the recommendations of the High Level Review Panel fully implemented? And then that would then link with your question to ask, would a strategy be needed prior to the crafting of the legislation? And I think the one speaks to the other. Chairperson, I'd like to align my thoughts and my advice in terms of the input that was made by Professor Jane Duncan, where she states that, and who gives us critical insight of what the crafters of the High Level Review Panel were thinking, as she was part of the High Level Review Panel, where she starts off by saying that her sentiments were, although the bill is progressive and an initiative that is welcomed, it stops short of fully implementing a lot of the recommendations that were made by the High Level Review Panel. And where we see these issues come in are things like the issue of the IGI, the issue of the IGI and its independence, the issue of NICOG. We're seeing that, you know, recommendations are made to narrow the powers of the minister, and yet we're seeing that again just being reinstated in clause 12, I think, of the bill, where they just, you know, almost copy-paste what was spoken about the powers of the minister again, and that was, you know, a thorough review was called for that. We see that issue again come up in vetting, where the High Level Review Panel called for a shrinking of a nuanced vetting, and also started by saying that perhaps the agency or whatever the intelligence services would have looked like, go and do a review first and determine if one, go and do a review to balance one, the legislative obligation versus the policy requirement, and then while you're doing that, try to find a nuanced perspective on how you're going to conduct vetting investigation, because as it is, it isn't seeming to be feasible, given the fact that there were so many backlogs with regards to vetting investigation. So again, yes, and you'll see, Chairperson, why I say it links to yours, is that in the theme in the High Level Review Panel says, it starts off by saying, review this, and as you review it, perhaps it would require legislative change. It would say, do a strategy, an overall architectural assessment of what the intelligence community looks like, and that would then give you guidance. And I think it's Professor Antoni who then says, the strategy is a contextualizes, anchors, and guides. the community. So it gives you a framework of which you're working in, and then from there you're able to then say, this ought to be legislated, this ought to be reviewed, this doesn't need amendment, or this needs just regulations or subordinate legislation, if you will. So it does, although not necessarily a prerequisite, but it's helpful, particularly when you're in a form. And when you're reforming something, it means that you need to inform yourself about how you see or how you envision the change to be. So the two then speak to each other in that way.
My doctor? Honorable Colabana?
Yes, it's just a follow-up on that. Could you tell me, is it the minister who is responsible for driving the establishment of the national security strategy? Who does this fall? I mean, it's been very difficult for this committee because we have this revolving door. Ministers last about a year, and they're out. I think there have been three or four since I've been here. But prior to that, it was many more. Is it the minister's responsibility? Could you just, I don't know where it lies. I don't believe it's the committee's responsibility to launch that. But I would be very interested to see if it could be legislated, that it has to be reviewed annually or biannually. But where does it come from? Thank you.
I see some of you are not very sure. But I should think it must come from the department.
Yes.
It must be developed from, it's like a white paper, you come with a blue paper, white paper, all from the department, regulations, and it must come from there, maybe be referred to us to concur or something of that nature. But they must all come from the department, that's their job.
And nothing has come.
It hasn't been coming, and if, oh, sorry. Sometimes, because I've got two heads, sometimes, okay, my doctor?
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just a quick reference to the question by Honorable Hadebe, in addition to what Nomulola said. If you look at this document on page 108, there was an input by Intel Watch at the bottom of page 108 where it speaks specifically to this issue that you asked.
Mm-hmm.
That last block on page 108 says, this bill fails to address the following matters raised by the High Level Review Panel. So I think, in addition to what Nomulola said, perhaps you can consider that those matters on page 108 in relation to your question.
Can you align yourself with them?
Oh, no, that is not. I'm just highlighting that. I'm stepping into the fray. Chair, the issue around the DOD, just want to get to the right page with me.
92.
Yes, 92 and 93. The issue there is more during your deliberations. On page 93, there's a in the middle of the page, there's a section involved. And that is a recommendation that was received from the DoD around, the issue is around collecting domestic covert intelligence and specifically in preparation for potential deployment. So they argue in the top of that section, they argue that uninterrupted collection must be allowed in order to be prepared for potential deployment. So that's their argument. So in the bottom section there, they argue that this recommendation should be included. For the Defense Force, through its intelligence division, may, in order to fulfill its constitutional mandate, and then they give the sections of the Constitution there, at the bottom, not involved, is gather domestic intelligence in a covert manner. So this, when the only input that is in that footnote says that if the committee considers this provision that they submitted only makes provision for collecting intelligence when there is a domestic deployment in terms of the Constitution. But the Defense Act itself also allows for deployment of the Defense Force. So they don't, in their own submission, they don't make allowance to collect intelligence when the defense force is deployed in terms of the Defense Act. For example, the president can deploy the defense force for a number of reasons, mm-hmm. but the Defense Act allows the minister of the defense to deploy the defense force for border security. Now, if the Defense Act is not included in this provision, then they can't collect intelligence for border security. But that is a secondary discussion and a point. The first is that during the deliberations will be whether this provision should be included in this law, whether it's the correct place to include it, or whether this is an operational matter that can be addressed in another way or through regulations. But that is for the committee to decide. The only point we're making in the footnote is that if this is included here, provision should perhaps also be made for deployment in terms of the Defense Act and the Constitution. That's the point.
I'm not sure whether I'm hearing you right. So for now, because my question was, what the legislation that is there now, is it not enough or is it enough? A layman would like to start there, and then I can understand whether we need to put in something in the or what they have now, is it enough? That was my question.
Sure, I'll have to go in depth into it, but and perhaps look at it more in depth. I think the argument was that there is a requirement for them to collect domestic intelligence, but that is not provided for in the current bill. In legislation, there is this requirement, I think, in the Defense Act, but this current bill doesn't provide for them to actually fulfill that mandate. That's the starting point.
Okay, now I understand the way the question came. Meaning that the employment into the gang-infested area would need them to have some intelligence before they go. That's what they are saying.
Yes.
And there's no. Oh, okay. No. Then I get the. Can I have the legal advisor? I saw your hand was going up.
No, you're scratching his head.
I must have been. Chair, I must have been scratching my head, but just to say, that the power to make legislation is an original constitutional entitlement of parliament. Mm-hmm. And that the white paper, the national strategic strategy, and all of those documents are policy documents in the purview of the executive. And in any way, they in no way impede the legislative process. For what it would have been prudent to have done that before legislation was introduced, but it doesn't stop what the committee is currently doing in terms of the Constitution. Thank you, Chair.
You are not actually scratching your hand. Your head was up and I saw you. Any other questions?
Clarification. Let me avoid saying questions.
Let me just say clarification. Any other clarifications?
No.
Nothing. Then,
Chair. Yes, no, the clarification that I saw that I was hesitant to ask. In terms of the safeguards that are apparently lacking, should those be reflected in the Act, or we can make regulations to cater for such? Would that suffice in ensuring that we cater for such, or those safeguards ought to be reflected in the current Act? For example, the issue of privacy, ensuring that the bulk interception does not infringe on the rights, all those that were highlighted. So you can just get that guidance, so that we are clear of the direction. Perhaps we get guidance on the direction that we ought to take then.
read, before you answer.
No, in essence, what I'm trying to establish, can the Act cater for everything? That's what I'm trying to
ask. Meaning that the regulation?
No, I'm saying, can't some of the issues here be catered
in the regulation? Yes.
We don't come with the Act this big.
Mm-hmm. Surely there are those that need to be in the legislation. Mm-hmm. I would think so. Because otherwise you are going to make a secondary legislation. The regulations, my understanding, how are you going to implement what is in the legislation? But let me throw it to our legal advisor. I was just trying to
learned friend
throw around my school fees
within
myself.
I welcome your night school classes, Chair.
Okay, over to you, legal advisor.
No, thank you, Chair. You have hit it on the nail. You've hit the nail on the head, as they say. The role of regulation is to operationalize legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So regulations don't give the original power; they are subordinate legislation. So Parliament makes the law, creates the broad framework principles, and then to give operation to those principles, it delegates the power to the executive to make regulations for day-to-day operation, to avoid having a bulky legislation. So it is always to be avoided, Chair, to give the protections of what should be in the principal act to delegate them to the executive to make regulation in respect of that matter. You will see, Chair, that is the experience that we've now seen recently in the Amabungani judgment in respect of direct interception of communication, where the court directed that the actual protection on how that whole process takes place must be in the actual legislation, which is the written. So it is always advisable to build in the protection in the actual legislation rather than to dedicate them into subordinate legislation. Thank you so much.
Any other things?
Well covered.
If not, the next item on the
Actually, we are not meet the prerequisite of the adoption.
Okay, maybe. What we have now, the constitutionality of the bill, is it as it is with before we come to inserting this and that? Does it just give me the relationship? As it is now, what do we have?
Chair, the direct answer to your question is that, in our view, the bill would not pass constitutional muster on the issues as outlined in the public participation report, which is that definitions, compulsory vetting, vast surveillance, as well as independence of the two institutions, being NECOG and the IGR. So broadly, Chair, those are the issues that could bring constitutional challenges to what the bill is currently. Thank you, Chair.
That's exactly what I wanted to understand. So it means we still have got a lot to do,
yes, Chair.
Which I don't like. Okay, besides that, any other thing before we... The next item is closure. If there's no other thing.
No.
We discuss. When are we discussing Friday?
The deliberations. Yes. Friday. We start in the morning until we finish, which might be at 9 in the evening.
All right.
what the program is saying. Any other thing before I declare the meeting closed?
Yeah.
No, the meeting is then closed.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Thank you for explaining.
Yeah, no, the meeting is closed, but I forgot to thank our presenters.
The A team.
The A team, yeah, this makes sense. I mean, even the way it is structured, for lay people like myself and Honorable Hadebe, this makes a lot of sense.
Do you still remember that TV service called the A-Team?
Yeah, and